Hello and welcome to episode number 40 of Cho Squared. Round numbers, you gotta love them. I'm your host, Andrew Chelney, and as per usual, we've got a ton to talk about today. Before we get into it here, same spiel every week, but the importance is never lost. Please follow the podcast on Twitter at Cho Squared and on Facebook at Cho Squared for more hot takes, news about future guests, poll questions, and a whole lot more. Please rate the show if you enjoy listening. It means more to me than I could put into words. And every time you either like the show on SoundCloud, give it a rating on iTunes, follow it on Spotify, etc., a puppy gets a hug from its owner. I don't make the rules here, just making sure you are in the know. If you prefer listening to podcasts on YouTube, search Cho Squared Podcast. And the show is there too. The show is everywhere from iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, every other platform that you listen to podcasts on. If Cho Squared isn't on your preferred platform, shoot me a tweet or a DM and I'll put it on there. This episode is dedicated to the Vancouver Canucks, a team that was out of the playoff race for seemingly the entire season, now finds itself 4 points out of the final wildcard spot in the Western Conference. Now, before I run down the topics for the show, though, I want to give a quick, massive shout-out to my boys, the Syracuse University men's ice hockey team, ESCHL champs. Extremely proud of them for bringing home the hardware. For those that don't know, I was the team's beat reporter until I graduated in December. Real quick here, I want to run down just how ridiculous this playoff run was for this team. Stay with me here. This is one of the most incredible things to ever happen in sports, and I can assure you that it will never happen again, probably. The SU men's hockey team plays in the ACHA, which is a step below the NCAA, but still very competitive. The top 20 teams make it to nationals, and as luck would have it, the team would be the 21st team, so they only made it to regionals. They ranked number third in the tourney. Tourney was last week in Pennsylvania. Friday, 1 p.m., they play the quarterfinals against number six, NYU, a team they have history with, and the two teams are not big fans of each other. NYU goes up 4-0 after the first period. Goaltending change is made. Mike Kuzo, remember that name, comes in for Jake Kaler. 7 minutes in the second period, NYU makes it 6-1. Syracuse head coach Connor Tracy called a timeout. Syracuse then comes all the way back to tie the game at 6. NYU scores to make it 7-6. Crunch time in the third period. Syracuse pulls Kuzo. Empty net with a minute to go. Syracuse ties the game at 7. Overtime is 20 minutes, 5-on-5 until someone scores. First OT, nothing gets done. Second OT, Syracuse forward Owen Harrington is the hero, and Syracuse wins 8-7. Semis are the next day at 8 o'clock p.m. Kaler reclaims his net for the semis in a game against number 2 Stony Brook. They lead 2-1 with just seconds left on the clock in the third period. With 13.9 seconds to go, scramble in front of the Stony Brook net, the ref calls one of their players for covering the puck in the crease. So Peter Owen Hayward, guy probably has the silkiest mitts in the entire league, gets a penalty shot, ties the game, and then Syracuse scores just 60 seconds in overtime. They are finals bound. Championship game Sunday at 2:10 p.m. So keep in mind, all this is happening in a roughly 48-hour span. They're playing number one Liberty, a team projected to win the tourney in the preseason coaches poll. Mike Kuzo in net for Syracuse. Deja vu of the semis. Syracuse down 2-1 with seconds to go. Kuzo gets pulled for an extra attacker. With 23 and a half seconds left, Syracuse ties the game. It's going to OT. No one scores in the first one, but in the second one, 3:59 remaining in double overtime, Syracuse goaltender Mike Kuzo has stopped, get this, 72 of 74 shots on goal. He's playing the game of his absolute life right now. Captain Connor McNamara, who's been held scoreless in his last 17 games, a senior, the last game of his career, gets a pass right in the slot and beats the Liberty goaltender to win the game and the tourney for Syracuse. So to recap, Syracuse was down 6-1, came back, final seconds, won double overtime. Then played a game the next day, tied that game in the final seconds, and won it in overtime. Then the next day, they They came back in the final seconds and won in double overtime while Mike Kuzo played the best game of his career, stopping 72 of 74 shots. That was the most nerve-wracking weekend I've ever witnessed, and it's something the sport of hockey probably won't see again for a very, very long time. Still with me? I told you it was worth your time. Anyway, one more quick thing I want to add here. I'm now employed, which is awesome. I'm now an associate producer at SiriusXM NBA. First day is Monday, and I'm super excited to get going. Nothing about this podcast should change. Things should be the same, though I'm considering moving recording uploading day to Saturdays to make it easier on time for me, but I'll see how that goes and see what you have to say about it if that's a problem for you. Also, birthday tomorrow, 22 years old. Jeez, I mean, next thing you know, I'll be getting my AARP card in the mail very, very shortly. All right, anyways, the Vancouver Canucks here, suddenly in a playoff race, but will they make it or should they make it to begin with? What's the draft day, July 1st game plan in Vancouver? Are they trying to be competitive next season or is the rebuild still ongoing? Brock Besser, a big name that needs a new big deal. We'll talk how much he might be making. Goldobin having massive struggles this season. Why? We'll try to figure it out. The blue line needs new money, but will it be status quo or revamp for those six spots? Demko needs a new deal. Will it be bridge until Markstrom's deal is over, or will he be getting a long deal to lock him up for the future? And how is the future of the Vancouver Canucks looking, really? How set is this team moving forward? How good is the pipeline for the Vancouver Canucks? So we'll get into all of that, the poll question, and a whole lot more. Finally, get to introduce the guest here. Joining me today is one half of the Silky and Filthy podcast, a Canucks analyst for Canucks Misconduct, Trevor Beggs. How's it going, Trev? Welcome to the show.
Hey, Andrew. How's it going? Thanks for having me on, and congratulations to you. You got some big things going on in your life.
Absolutely.
Got the birthday,
thank you.
Got the new gig. Your university hockey team was absolutely lighting it up. I mean, big things happening in your life, man. Good for you.
Absolutely, man. Thank you. I was watching the live streams. I was holding on my computer for dear life because it was very nerve-wracking for me, and I wasn't even there. I was watching it on a stream, and I can't even imagine what it was like being either on the ice or behind the bench or watching that game live. I mean, I was losing my mind. And then when they finally scored, Captain Mac, oh man, I almost lost my mind. I'm surprised I didn't get a noise complaint because I was very, very vocal about that team winning. Very, very exciting stuff.
Well, I don't blame you. And I think sometimes in hockey, you know, us guys, we're always on the podcast talking about the stats behind the game, trying to analyze teams, trying to analyze players, dig into the numbers. But sometimes you just got lady luck on your side. And I think that's what happened with Syracuse by the sounds of it. I mean, I didn't know much about their success coming into this podcast, but hearing all of that, the come from behind victories, hot goalie at the right time, goals at the right time, sometimes luck's on your side.
Absolutely. I mean, they are a great, great group, and they absolutely deserve the success that they've had. And it was just super great to see, because they absolutely, first of all, they deserve to make nationals. That team was really good. They deserved to make nationals and they didn't. And I feel like if you win regionals, you should get a bid to nationals anyway. I'm kind of mad about that, but that's beside the point. So I know that was a longer intro than I would do otherwise, but there's a chance for you to make it even. So before we get into the super nitty gritty here, tell me the craziest sporting event you've either been that you've ever been a part of or witnessed or something along those lines.
Ooh, let me think about that one for a second. I don't know if there's one sporting event that stands out. In terms of atmosphere, the only playoff game I'd ever gone to was the Canucks in 2012. So we're talking about the first playoff game against the LA Kings, their first game since losing game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals against Boston. So, I mean, I just had absolute goosebumps. The crowd's going crazy. Everyone's getting pumped up. You know, all Canucks fans are looking at each other thinking, no, here we go again. Let's get it done. And then obviously LA won that game and then won three more. So that game wasn't so memorable itself. But I remember the energy in that building before the game was insane. And I would say, though, the first Canucks game I ever went to, it was the Canucks and the Blackhawks. And it just ended up being one of those real physical affairs. Everyone was chipping at each other, hitting each other. It felt like good old-fashioned Broad Street bullies hockey. And one of the highlights of the game, a few rows up from where I was sitting, Steve Bernier absolutely pelted one of the Blackhawks defensemen through the glass. And that was my first Canucks game. And I just remember I jumped out of my seat, the whole crowd's going nuts. So that's a moment that really stood out to me, that's for sure.
I mean, it sounds like an interesting game to be at. That's definitely for sure. Especially, I mean, obviously losing a playoff game, not the greatest thing, but just being a part of the atmosphere is absolutely. Yeah, the only NHL playoff game that I was a part of live was 2015 Rangers Caps. Caps were up 3-1 in that series. So if they would have won that game, it would have been over. And we got front row seats. It was the most incredible experience I've ever been a part of. The seats were literally pretty much on the ice almost. And the Caps scored, I think it was Curtis Glencross. Oh boy, what a name.
Oh,
I think it was
Glencross
that got the opening goal. I think it was late in the second period too, or something along those lines. And then it was 1-0 in the third period, and then Lundqvist was pulled. And then Kreider scored with like a minute 18, I think it was 1:18 to go in regulation, tied the game. MSG went absolutely ballistic, as you would assume. And then in overtime, I think it was Ryan McDonagh who scored the game winner. And then the Rangers went on to win that series. So it was I've never been a part of a louder building. I was kind of afraid, honestly, that the roof would implode because it was so extremely loud with everyone just yelling their absolute lungs out. It was, oh man, that's a game that I will never forget. The atmosphere, the game itself, it's you can't beat it.
Yeah, you know what? There's just something about playoff hockey. And again, it's just another reason why I think the NHL is the best league out there. I just feel like there's nothing like playoff hockey. No, it's a 7-game grind. And especially when you get towards the end of the series there, these game fives, game six, game seven, the intensity level is just right up there with anything you can see in sports.
Absolutely. Especially you got the towels going, you got everyone's on edge. Especially in the later rounds too. Obviously first round is crucial because if you don't win round one, you can't win round two. But as you go into later rounds, every little thing is that much more important. Everyone is hyper focused and obviously wanting their team to win. So it is a different beast all in itself. Now, before we lose everyone here, the Vancouver Canucks, the team that I have asked you to come on to talk about, are suddenly, almost out of nowhere, 4 points out of a playoff spot. I mean, this has been a run that I feel like no one has expected, to be honest with you, because the Canucks were out of it for seemingly the entire season. And yet here we are, March 21st at 5:14 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Vancouver Canucks at 74 points are 4 behind the Arizona Coyotes, who have 78, though the Coyotes have a game in hand, but they lost their last game against the Lightning, which to be expected is the Tampa Bay Lightning, and they are just far and away the best team in the galaxy right now. But the Canucks have won their past 3 in a row. They look down and out, and now they're seemingly back in it. I mean, what's been the secret in Vancouver the last few games?
Oh, geez, we're going to be talking about playoffs, eh? I thought this was all done. I thought this was all said and done, and then last night happens. And here's the thing, you know, we're talking about the Canucks being 4 points out of the playoffs. Last night against the Senators, they had a 5-0 lead in the third period, right, and they almost blew it. They came so close to blowing that game. You know, I think the Senators had like 13 shots in the first 48 minutes, and all of a sudden they ripped off 4 goals in the last 12 minutes. And then all of a sudden it's a 5-4 game, and then obviously Horvat and Eriksson sealed it with Horvat's tip-in and then Eriksson's empty netter. But I just think the playoffs are still a mirage in Vancouver, and I know a lot of fans want to say, yeah, Vancouver's been surprising, and they have been. I think everyone expected Vancouver to be a bottom five team again this year. But the secret to their success, it lies probably within 4 or 5 players. I mean, Brock Besser's got an 8-game point streak going. Horvat's got points, 9 points in his last 6 games. Pettersson's got points in 7 of his last 8 games. Markstrom's been playing good hockey, minus, you know, letting four goals in 12 minutes at the
minus
end of the game.
Minus almost blowing
night.
That game, right.
But he's been pretty solid since December 1st. I'd say he's easily a top 10 goalie in the league since then. Probably could be one of the most underrated goalies in the league right now, the way he's been playing. And I'd say on the blue line, Troy Stetcher, he's been an absolute rock for the Canucks. So those five guys, night in and night out, have been amazing. At the end of the day, though, this team just utterly lacks depth. Like, I look at a team like Arizona, they don't have the stars like Besser, like Horvat, like Pettersson, but they have a ton of depth that they're getting it done with. You know, guys like Richard Ponick, Nick Cousins, Vinny Hinostroza, Brad Richardson, who lit us up for four goals in the game. So the Canucks definitely have a ton of holes in their lineup, but I'd be lying if I said this race wasn't a little bit intriguing.
I'm interested when you said Markstrom has been a top 10 goalie since December 1st, because my follow-up question was going to be, because I obviously don't watch as many Canucks games as you do, so this opinion could be a little incorrect. Or, by the way, I appeared on your podcast a few months ago talking about the Rangers, and there was one opinion that I had at the time that I absolutely am recanting, and I am admitting that I was super incorrect about. You asked me if 5 years down the road, if I'd rather have Neil Pionk or Brady Shea.
Oh,
I said Neil Pionk.
I knew this was it.
And I very, very extremely regret saying that. I would very, very much rather have Brady Shea than Neil Pionk. Neil Pionk, for all the points he puts up, is not good defensively. He's kind of like Kevin Shattenkirk. If Kevin Shattenkirk was putting up points in New York, which he's not. I mean, he has been recently, I think something along the lines of 11 assists in his last 16 or 17 games or something like that. So he's been better on the offensive side. But Neil Pionk is not a good defenseman, and I would very much rather have Brady Shea over Neil Pionk. So I am recanting the statement that I had on your show, on the record, absolutely on the record. That statement is being tossed out the window. Regarding Markstrom, though, again, you watch more Canucks games than I do, so this could be incorrect here. But I was always under the assumption that, I mean, whenever I would watch Markstrom play, that he just wasn't, one, capable enough to be a starting goaltender in the NHL, and two, I had doubts that he could be an NHL goaltender at all. Is that wrong of me to suggest? Because you just said that he could potentially be, from December 1st on, one of the best goalies in the league. So clearly there's some disconnect here, but you watch more Canucks games than I do, so I feel like there's more weight on what you're saying than I'm saying. But convince me that Markstrom isn't just an option, but is the option to lead a team.
Well, I think, first of all, you are right about your assessment of Markstrom before this season, and even 2 months into the season as well. You know, last year, a 912 save percentage, it was respectable. But one of Markstrom's problems has always been he was always letting in a bad goal. And often it came early in the game, and it killed the momentum for the Canucks. They were playing catch-up hockey. And the other thing about Markstrom was just his attitude. He would lose his cool in the net. He would yell at his teammates sometimes. So what's really changed with Markstrom this year, aside from switching goaltending coaches? He went to Ian Clark, who was the goaltending coach for Sergei Bobrovsky previously. So that's helped too, the goalie coach. But really, I think it's Markstrom's attitude. You know, he's not flipping out at teammates. He's not losing his cool in games. He's just calm, cool, and collected. And whatever it was, that switch flicked at the turn of December. Since the turn of December, Markstrom's 923 save percentage is ninth among starters. He's got 19 wins, which is 10th among starters. So he's up there, I'm telling you. He's a top 10 goalies from December 1st onwards. And he has kept the Canucks in every game. You know, one of my favorite stats I like to look at is scoring chances for and against. This is subjective, but in my opinion, I just think a scoring chance means more than a shot or a Corsi attempt. To me, it signifies that you're actually getting pucks on the net. You're not just playing the LA Kings hockey where you're dumping pucks in from wherever and racking up the Corsi numbers. And for scoring chances against, the Canucks are fourth worst in the league. Only Ottawa, Anaheim, and Chicago are worse. And those are teams that allow a lot of goals. So Markstrom has seen a ton of rubber this season. He's played almost as much as any goalie in the league. He's up to 56 games with 8 more to go. He should surpass the 60-game mark for the second time in his career. But he's just been an absolute rock for the Canucks, you know? It tended to be in Markstrom's career previously, he would have a bad game probably every one or two games. It's hard to really point a bad game out for Markstrom since December 1st. He got pulled against the Vegas Golden Knights earlier in March, and it was the first time he's been pulled all season. Even the best goalies in the game are getting pulled at least a couple times a season, so that just shows you how consistent Markstrom's been. And again, he plays behind an absolutely porous defense, and he's held the fort down.
It's so weird, you know, to hear this about Markstrom, because again, like you just said, prior to December 1st, he was pretty much an afterthought in the NHL, right? And now for the past 3 months, it's been, okay, this is one of the best goalies in the league. To go from afterthought to a solidified goaltender in the National Hockey League is one that is, one, almost impossible to switch during a season, prior to a season, any season. It's almost impossible to do. And two, to do it at a time where the Canucks really needed it is so great on so many levels. The game against Ottawa, though, I mean, again, I don't watch every Canucks game. I can't watch every Canucks game. But I would assume that you at the very least watch more Canucks games than I do. That game against the Senators is 5-0. And then, like you said, in the third period, Ottawa just comes out and scores 4 in a row. There were a couple of goals in there that shouldn't go in if you're an NHL goaltender. So I still have my reserves about calling him a top 10 goaltender right now, even though the stats right now say otherwise. My issue with him is the leaky goal, is the goal that you shouldn't give up in a hockey game, especially in crunch time. And he tends to do that more often than a goaltender should. Obviously, right? Goaltenders are human. Everyone's human. Things will happen, and there's going to be a bad goal against. There's going to be a bad opportunity or whatever that ends up in the back of your net. It happens. You're never going to get rid of that in the game. But it just feels like to me that it happens against Markstrom more frequently than it does to any other goaltender. Is that true? Am I on the right track, or am I just completely missing the point of Jacob Markstrom?
I'd say that was true about Markstrom probably before this season. You know, in the last few months, he's really shored up, and those leaky goals haven't happened. And I will say, with the short sample size you're seeing from Markstrom, going back to the Ottawa game last night, Markstrom is used to facing a ton of shots. There was a stretch in February where the Canucks had given up 40-plus shots and the 3 or 4 straight starts for Markstrom. But he's faced a ton of rubber. That game against Ottawa last night, again, he faced 13 shots in the first 48 minutes of that game. So it's pretty much backwards world from what Markstrom's used to. And I think of that game, you know, often goalies will say, when they're not seeing pucks early on, you become kind of static in the net. You're waiting for that chance, and sometimes you're not ready for it when it comes. And I think the Canucks, you know, played a pretty good game. They were dominating a pretty pathetic Ottawa team. And the last 10, 12 minutes, they just sat back, and the goal started slipping in past Markstrom. But for the most part, he shored it all up.
Fair point. I mean, Markstrom is making around $3.67 million until the end of next season. But Thatcher Demko is due for a new contract. His ELC expires this season. He's an RFA at the end of it. What is the plan, or at least what should Vancouver do regarding Thatcher Demko? If Markstrom is playing like you were saying, if he's playing great, and if he continues to play great, then I'm not suggesting you should trade Thatcher Demko and keep Jacob Markstrom. That is absolutely not what I'm suggesting. Thatcher Demko is going to be a fantastic goaltender in this league. But what would the contract look like for him come this offseason? Because there's an assumption that he's going to be the starting goaltender once Markstrom's contract expires. But what would you give him? Would you give him a bridge deal while Markstrom is playing this well? Or do you lock him up right now and say, okay, we are putting all of our chips in you. You are going to be the starting goaltender, and Markstrom is going to hold down the fort until the end of next season, and then it will be your net from there. What's the plan with Demko?
I think the plan is probably to give him what Corey Schneider had as a backup here. You know, get him 20 to 25 games next season in his first full season. Contract-wise, I would imagine they're going to give Demko a 2-year deal for something probably in the $2 million range. Like, look, he's a fantastic prospect. He's had great success in the AHL, but he's only played like 6 or 7 games at the NHL level so far. So how much money are you really going to give a guy when he doesn't have the NHL experience? And as for Markstrom, I mean, I think the Canucks have no choice but to discuss a contract extension right now. I mean, a very bold thing to try and do, and this has been a rumor that's kind of been circling underground in Vancouver, is maybe you try to sell high on Markstrom, but then you have absolutely zero backup for Thatcher Demko. There are some UFA goalies this year, like Thomas Greiss, Yaroslav Halak. So that could be a possible plan. Maybe you sell high on Markstrom to a desperate team, sign a veteran goalie to play with Thatcher Demko. But at the moment, I see them re-signing Markstrom. I got to say, I don't have a lot of faith in Benning and the contracts he signs. He tends to overpay. He tends to give too much length. But I think if Demko is your goalie of the future, you can't extend Markstrom much past 2 years. And it would probably be in the, I would imagine, the $6 million range. And I'm fine with that number. But if you start talking 3, 4, 5 years for Markstrom, you know, Demko's going to be in his mid to late 20s by then. If Demko's still going to be your starter and he's done nothing to prove that he shouldn't be the goalie of the future, you can only sign Markstrom short term. And at that point, if Demko starts to rise up and starts to become the starting goalie, then it's maybe it's time to move on from Markstrom. But at the end of the day, I think the plan here is still for Demko to be the starter long term. Although Markstrom's success has been great, I don't know if that really changes the trajectory for Thatcher Demko too much.
I talked to Rick Carpinello, who covers the Rangers for The Athletic, a few weeks ago. I threw the question of, obviously, the, you know, Trey Lundquist, the fanatics of that move. And he brought up a good point, at least for this season, right? Even if the Rangers wanted to trade Henrik Lundquist, who would take him? Because every playoff team, at least as of this season, as of this playoff push, has a goaltender that they are comfortable with rolling with. So it really hinges on the idea that Markstrom, if you sign him to an extension and he continues to prove that he is worth that kind of money, the problem that you might run into if you're Vancouver, if you're Jim Benning, is, okay, well, 2-3 years down the road, right, if you sign him to a longer term deal than perhaps you should, the question now becomes, well, you have to trade him at a certain point if Demko becomes a starting goaltender, which, again, like you just said, there's no reason to believe that he's not going to be that. He eventually will be. So if you give him a longer deal, you're going to have to move him at some point. And if this trend continues of playoff teams actually having capable goaltenders and you have to move him, that might be a big problem unless you move him at the draft or during the off season. But then, you know, then you can't play the season by ear. Then that becomes a whole different issue in and of itself. So the problem really lies with Markstrom and the contract that Benning is looking to give him. Because like you said, Benning is kind of all over the place when it comes to giving out contract extensions and contracts in general. So the problem that Vancouver might very well run into is, okay, we've given Markstrom a year longer than he should have gotten, and now we can't do anything with him because the teams that are in a playoff spot don't need a goaltender like Jacob Markstrom.
Right, and I think this is just one of the reasons why this is going to be one of the most critical off seasons in recent Canucks history. You know, they've already made some mistakes by signing guys like Jay Beagle to 4-year contracts, and it kind of changes the market for Alex Edler. How does Alex Edler ask for anything less than 3 years when your fourth line center has got 4 years and even 3 years left on his deal? And this is going to become a problem with Markstrom too. I think the Canucks can't sign Markstrom to a 3, 4, 5 year deal. It has to be a short deal if you think Demko is still the goalie of the future. Now, if they sign him to a longer term contract, it might mean moving on from Thatcher Demko. Is that a risk you want to take? I mean, Markstrom floundered for, you know, 5, 6 years previously in the NHL before this season. Do you trust that body of work, or do you trust the most recent body of work with Markstrom? Or do you put your faith in the guy that you drafted and who's performed really well in the minors? I would lean towards the latter. I think Demko is the guy for the job. I think with enough experience in the NHL, he's going to earn that opportunity. And I'm just crossing my fingers, my toes, I'm crossing my hairs, and I'm just hoping that Benning doesn't make a mistake with Markstrom.
What about Brock Besser, right? His ELC expires at the end of this season. Obviously, one of your top scorers, like you said earlier, 8-game point scoring streak, 52 points in 61 games this season, third on the team behind Bo Horvat and Elias Pettersson. He's going to want some money. He's going to want a big chunk of change here. You currently are pretty flexible when it comes to the cap. You are projected to have around $8.5 million as of right now, according to Cap Friendly, of course. But he's going to take up, I would assume, a fair chunk of that, and for a long deal, because he is 22 years old and one of your top scorers. I feel like the last thing you should do is either give him a bridge deal or sell him short. You don't want to make Brock Besser angry, because he's Brock Besser and he's one of your best players. But the idea is that you sign Besser to whatever kind of contract he wants, almost. You also have to sign Granlund. You also have to sign some lesser players in Tyler Motte and Josh Levo. Nikolai Goldobin, who's been struggling for the entire season. Before we get into the RFAs and then the money talk here, Nikolai Goldobin, I mean, 23 years old. He's going to be an RFA at the end of the year, but I don't understand what is going on with him and his on-ice production. He has 7 goals, 20 assists, good for 27 points, but there's been a lot of communication, at least that I'm reading, that he either isn't giving 100% on the ice, or there's some attitude problems or whatever it is. Whether that is true or whether that is false, there needs to be something that clears up this haze regarding Nikolai Goldobin, because it seems to me like he should at least be somewhat better than he is now, and yet he's not living up to those expectations, even though they're not very high. So what's the problem, I guess you could say, with Nikolai Goldobin, and how do you fix it?
Oh man, the Goldie situation. You know what? Goldobin has to be one of the most talked about under 30 point scorers in Canucks history. I mean, this is what happens on a bad team. You talk a lot about guys who have that potential but just can't quite get there. And I think the most divisive thing about Goldie is when he has the puck on his stick, he can make amazing plays. And to start the season, he was riding hot. He looked great with Elias Pettersson. He was producing at even strength. He was producing on the power play. But Travis Green has just never been a fan of Nikolai Goldobin's game. And there's been reports here that, you know, he's shown Nikolai Goldobin video and Goldobin's given him backlash, saying, other guys are doing this too. Why are you picking on me? So it really just seems like the relationship is fractured beyond repair with Green and Goldobin. And that's unfortunate, because he's really flashed a lot of potential during his time in Vancouver. And I've been a Goldie backer, but at the same time, when you're Goldobin, you have to produce. And over the past 30 games, he's only put up about 6 points. So his production has absolutely fallen off a cliff after scoring, you know, almost 20 points in his first 30 games. When you're a player like Goldobin, who doesn't defend well on his own end, who is going to give up some chances, you got to be able to put the puck in the back of the net. And granted, Goldie's had some bad puck luck. He's had some posts. He's been robbed on a couple of chances point blank. But at the end of the day, 7 goals for a guy who's supposed to be a top 6 player is disappointing. And I'm not sure what the Canucks do afterwards, but my gut tells me that Goldobin isn't coming back to Vancouver.
So will they not even tender him? Are they going to trade him, do you think? Well, he's going to be an RFA, so what do you do?
My feeling is that they trade him for peanuts, or he goes back to Russia. That's just my gut feeling. I hope I'm wrong. I would like to see them give Goldie a longer chance, but he's been a healthy scratch for Tim Schaller recently, and Tim Schaller just scored his first goal of the season a few days ago. So that kind of tells you, in a nutshell, how Travis right. Green feels about Nikolai Goldobin. I honestly really liked him with Elias Pettersson. I think one of the best ways of breaking up the offense in Vancouver would be to put Horvat with Besser, because Horvat's played with absolutely no wingers this year. Like, he's just been, it's been a revolving door of Louis Eriksons and Tyler Motts and Ryan Spooners. I would love to see Horvat with Besser. I'd love to see Goldobin with Pettersson. Stick with those pairings for the end of the season and see what happens. But again, I think Green's beyond giving Goldie chances. He's been scratched for 3 straight games now, and we're getting towards the tail end of the season. And you know, this is the time to see what Goldie's got to give. It's kind of his last chance, and he's up sitting in the press box. So it's got to be disappointing for the player and disappointing for the organization who acquired him with hopes that he could be a top six player.
You mentioned Louis Eriksson, and I want to mention an idea that has been sort of circling around social media the last couple of days. If this is a joke, I would assume that this is at least sort of a joke. The idea of trading Louis Eriksson for Milan Lucic, two players that both contracts are horrid. They are clearly not the players that they once were. And I'm not even sure who this benefits, to be honest. But the idea is circulating around social media. What are your thoughts on this potential Lucic Eriksson one-for-one swap?
It makes me absolutely cringe, Andrew. It makes me cringe beyond belief. I mean, Uncle Louis's already been relegated to being a fourth liner. But honestly, Lucic is even worse than Eriksson. Lucic has 5 goals, 18 points, and he's just an absolute liability out there. I think at least Eriksson can skate, sort of.
Got 2 goals last night, right? What a sniper.
Oh, yeah, I know. 4 points last night. That was 15% of his production for the season. Not bad, eh? We mentioned on the Silky Filthy podcast last night that Eriksson has... I guess, what was the number? He's been paid $741,000 per goal during his 3 years in Vancouver.
Incredible.
That's a lot of money. A lot of money for a guy who doesn't score a lot. I'm sure if you put, you know, even some of the players from the Women's Hockey League, put Hillary Knight or Kim LeCoin in there, I bet they're going to score at least more than Louis Eriksson.
I mean, you put Hillary Knight on any team, she's going to score a lot of goals.
Exactly, right?
I would argue that she is probably the best female player right now, for sure. So if you put her on and take out Louis Eriksson, I would assume the Canucks get a lot better.
I would assume the same thing. Let's petition for this right now. You should create a poll and see what the Twitter world thinks. I'm sure Canucks fans are going to be all over the Hillary Knight bandwagon. I mean, she definitely hustled a lot more than Louis. Like, to me, Louis Eriksson is just one of the laziest players in the Canucks. He's never really hustling. He's always behind the play. All the reporters at the rink always say it during the morning skates and practices. He's always the first guy off the ice. He's never staying behind working on skills. And for the record, guys like Besser and Pettersson are always staying behind working on their shots or working on puck skills. Eriksson isn't doing anything. He's just collecting his $6 million, going home to his wife, living in fancy Westwood Plateau in Vancouver, and just living the dream. So, I mean, he's been bad. I had a little Louis rant last night on the Silky and Filthy podcast, but at the end of the day, I'd still prefer Louis Eriksson over Milan Lucic, which really says a lot about Milan Lucic and how far he's fallen as a player.
Very true. Also, Eriksson, I mean, here's the thing, right? As much as we don't like to admit this, Louis Eriksson doesn't have to try, right? At the end of the day, obviously, it's your job. You should try, and you should try to improve as much as you want. However, no trade clause, and even if he didn't have one, he wouldn't be able to be traded anyway because of his contract. He's making $6 million until 2022, and no one wants him, right? So at the end of the day, what are they going to do, buy him out? He's not going to make a lot of money anyway. So to him, it's not the greatest option, but I guess to him, it's the option that he's choosing. He's 33 years old, he's not getting any younger. I feel like his thought process is, okay, well, I'm going to be making, you know, $18 million until 2022. Obviously, that's without taxes. That's the number that Cap Friendly has, but that is not what his paychecks, that's not what his paycheck says. Obviously, you have to pay taxes and you have to pay your agent also. I feel like his agent I feel like Louis Eriksson should have a statue of his agent in his house or something along those lines, because his agent is making a lot of money off of this deal, I would assume. But as much as, you know, I don't want to admit this, as I'm sure no one really does, I feel like his thought process is, okay, well, you know, this team isn't playoff worthy or isn't good enough to make the playoffs, they might in 2 weeks, we don't know, because they're 4 points out of a spot right now. But maybe in his mind, his thought process is, yeah, I mean, I'm 33, I'm getting paid a lot of money, I'm not going anywhere, what's the point of trying? Which is not a great thought process to have, right? Obviously, you want your top players, or at least the players that make the top money on the team, to give it on to give 110% every game, but clearly that's not happening.
Yeah, lazy Uncle Louie. He does look checked out, and I do find it kind of laughable that he's really just slid down to the fourth line this year. Like, Louie Erickson, Jay Beagle, and Tyler Mott have just been this mediocre fourth line that Travis Green basically glued together for at least 2-3 months of the season. And I know Erickson, when he got his 4 points last night, was playing with Bo Horvat. What a surprise there. But, you know, I think the Canucks would just be better off to get out of that contract. And it's something that's doable. He gets paid a signing bonus on July 1st. And after that, he's only owed $9 million over 3 seasons. So while the cap hit is high, I like to think that the Canucks, if they set their minds to it, could get creative and try to move Erickson. But not for Milan Lucic.
No, so not for Lucic. What about the blue line? The Alex Edlers, the Ben Huttons, they all need new contracts. Edler's a UFA. Luke Shen's also a UFA, but I would wager that he won't be back with the team. Pouliot needs a new deal. What's the plan for the blue line coming into next season? Because I would assume that Edler's 32 years old, but I would assume that he stays in Vancouver. He's got the A on his sweater. I would assume that Vancouver would still want him back. What's the plan with the blue line? Is it going to be status quo? Or are you going to be re-signing them and not really doing a whole lot with the guys on the back end? Are you going to be looking at free agency, seeing who's out there? What, in your mind at least, what you think should be the plan for the Vancouver Canucks on the blue line?
Oh man, if I was in charge, I would just go hard after Erik Karlsson. I mean, that would be an Erik Karlsson, Quinn Hughes pairing. It gives me the best dreams at night, you know? It helps me get to sleep. It's great. But again, that's a bit of a pipe dream. It's probably not happening. I'm sure Karlsson is nice and happy in San Jose. What the Canucks cannot do is have the status quo. You mentioned status quo. They were status quo last season after allowing, you know, their bottom three in goals against. This year, they're right down there at the bottom again. I mentioned before, they allow the fourth most scoring chances in the league. But, you know, the Canucks had a chance to trade Alex Edler at the deadline. I mean, he has the no-trade clause, but it's not like the Canucks said, look, we're not re-signing you, we're going to shop you. They told him they were going to re-sign him, and then the report was that 2 days before the deadline, they got a sweet deal from Calgary and kind of half-heartedly asked him to waive, and he wouldn't. And that's kind of where we stand now. So, I mean, Alex Edler's coming back. The Canucks have basically said as much. It's really just the term I worry about. I mean, Edler's 32 years old. He's been injured a lot. I don't think he's played more than 70 games in the season much over the past couple seasons. I mean, him and Chris Tanev have got to be the worst, most injured first pairing in the NHL. So the Canucks really got to think about these things going forward. I mean, Edler's had a great season with 28 points in 48 games, but I think that's one of the things. He's only played 48 games. You know, 68 in 2016-17, 52 in 2015-16. He's a guy who gets injured a lot, so you just can't throw him a ton of money. And the Canucks seem like they want to change up their defense because they're sick of allowing all these goals. You know, Benning said as much at the deadline that, you know, the defense needs to be changed. But how much is it really going to change? You've shipped out Eric Branson. Derek Pouliot's not coming back. Derek Pouliot's already being benched for AHL call-up guys like Guillaume Brisebois and Ashton Sautner. So Derek Pouliot, he's just been a disaster defensively. He's not coming back. Ben Hutton, he's a guy they're probably going to resign. But at the same time, I could see them trading Ben Hutton. I kind of posted a funny tweet tongue-in-cheek the other day. So Ben Hutton and Jim Benning are tied on the Canucks franchise defenseman scoring list with 70 points. So, hey, maybe Benning just wants to ship Hutton out of town at the end of the season, keep him on injured reserve right now. And then Hutton won't pass him in the overall standings. So Hutton's an interesting name to me. The $2.8 million seemed like a huge overpayment last year when he was struggling, but he settled into a top four role this year. Ideally, I think Ben Hutton would be a third pairing defender on a good team, but he plays higher up in the lineup because the team's not very good. But next year, I think with a full year of Quinn Hughes, Alex Edler, and Ben Hutton, that's probably your left side, and that's much better than Derek Pouliot and what they had before. And then you have Chris Tanev and Troy Stetcher on the right side. Stetcher's been amazing. He's not going anywhere. Tanev's okay when he's healthy, but I think you need another impact right shot defenseman. But please, for the love of God, Canucks, don't go out and overpay Tyler Myers, because that's a big fear right now, is that the Canucks, they've been talking about improving the blue line in the offseason. And how are you going to do that if it's not, you know, through the draft or through free agency? And then they haven't made a ton of trades for defensemen, not good trades at least. Unless you're talking about shipping Eric Branson out of town.
That was the best deal you've made in the longest. Yeah. I can't believe I went on this huge rant a couple weeks ago after the deadline, just trashing the Penguins, and for good reason. You effectively traded a top nine forward, you could say. Tanner Pearson is a serviceable forward in this league for one of the worst defensemen in the entire league. And a potential Jack Johnson, Eric Branson pairing is the worst pairing in the sport of hockey. So to trade for him, Vancouver, I don't know how you managed to do that, but you absolutely fleeced Pittsburgh, which isn't saying a whole lot in that context. But to get rid of Eric Branson is addition by subtraction.
Oh, completely. He was an absolute liability for the Canucks. Turnovers every game. He got beat every game. Always chucking the puck up the boards to nobody, icing the puck for no reason. Oh man, I'm so glad Eric Branson is gone, I must say. And like Eric Branson was so bad that people are praising Luke Shen's play, and Luke Shen has been pretty mediocre. He hasn't done much for the Canucks in the shelter role. And yeah, it was definitely Benning's, I'd say, his best trade is the Canucks. And that's not actually saying much, because Pearson has been pretty inconsistent, and he has 2 years left on his contract. But yeah, just to get out of Eric Branson has already made this defense better.
The Canucks, 74 points, leads me into my poll question for this week. When will Vancouver become a team that'll consistently make the playoffs? And I put four choices. Now, this poll got over 90 votes. The four choices were 2019, so that's the assumption that they'll make the playoffs this season, 2020, 2021, or 2022 or later. Now, again, I can only put four choices, so I had to put or later at the end of that one. Before I tell you which of the choices is in the lead, Trev, which of the four choices would you say is the correct answer?
Oh, man. Again, I think so much hinges on this offseason, you know, what Benning does, who they draft. Sometimes the best moves are who they don't sign, so no overpaying Tyler Myers, no overpaying Edler, Markstrom, Wayne Simmons. Don't overpay any of these guys. I think the best case scenario is 2020, but more realistically, I'd say 2021 is probably a more realistic idea for the Canucks. Even 2022, like, look, the defense has Quinn Hughes, but it needs a ton of work after that. You need another impact player on that blue line. You need an impact winger for Bo Horvat still. You need some depth that isn't completely useless. So if I'm being optimistic, I'm going to say 2020. If I'm being realistic, I'm probably saying 2021.
It's funny because 2021 is in the lead, but it has 37% of the vote. 2020 has 36% of the vote. 2022 or later is in third place with 24% of the vote. And one or two very optimistic Canucks fans voted for 2019 because 2019 has 3% of the vote. Again, you're only 4 points out of a playoff spot, right? There's more than two games to go. So it's not looking great, but you won three in a row. Chicago lost an OT in their last game to the Vancouver Canucks. They played tonight against the Flyers. Colorado seemingly woken up from whatever season-long slump they've been in, besides, of course, the hot streak that they were in prior to, I mean, I can't remember right now, but it was, they were doing very well, and they just kind of fallen off a cliff. Now, seemingly, they've gotten back together. They won the past two games, or 5-5 in their last 10. They play tonight against Dallas. Now, that's going to be a huge game, because right now, I guess you could say Dallas is in a quote-unquote comfortable position. They are in the first wildcard spot with 82 games, with 82 points on the board. Arizona has 78 points sitting in that second wildcard spot. So, and the Dallas Stars are 7-2-1 in their past 10, so if they continue to play at this pace, I would have to assume that the race now is stuck between the Coyotes, the Wild, the Avalanche, the Blackhawks, and the Vancouver Canucks. So what is that? That's five teams. See, I didn't go to school for math, so I needed a second to count all these teams here.
I think you got it.
I think I got it right. So there's five spots. There's five teams fighting for what I would assume to be one spot, unless, of course, the Stars start losing, which, I mean, I guess could happen, but I would assume that if they at least play decently well, they are going to, at this point in time, hold on and make the playoffs. So it leads to five teams right now. It's kind of like trying to merge into a crowded highway lane. I mean, this is not going to be pretty. Five teams right now trying to log jam their way into the final spot in the playoffs. Vancouver now, I guess, included, although, again, like we talked about, they almost blew a 5-goal lead to Ottawa, and they look right against my Rangers, but again, that's not difficult to do this season. Although I would very much like to point out that 5-minute major game misconduct against Brandon Lemieux was the biggest farce I've ever seen. Anyway, my anger for that ridiculous penalty aside here, ridiculous. You have 8 games left in your schedule. 4 points back of the Coyotes, who have 4 points on you, but they do have a game in hand. Should you push for the playoffs? Do you think it's a good idea to even go for it? Obviously, making the playoffs is great, right? But looking at the competition, if you had to play the Calgary Flames in the first round of the playoffs, probably won't end well. And I mean, obviously, you never say never, right? You can't assume things, yada yada. But common knowledge would suggest that the Canucks won't do well against the Flames if that matchup were to happen in the first round of the playoffs. So, if they, let's say, make the playoffs and are swept or losing five or what have you, all that they end up doing is just getting a worse draft pick. They would end up drafting worse. So, because they're in this logjam in the middle of either just losing the rest of the games or trying to win them all, there's no in between. What should Vancouver do here? Should they just go all out and just try to pummel their way into that last playoff spot? Or do you think it's in their best interest to say, okay, we are close, but clearly we're not good enough to make the playoffs and compete in the playoffs, so we will instead kind of slow down and look at potentially drafting better?
What a question, man. Do the Canucks go all out or tank? I mean, what's best for the organization is clearly to lose. I mean, the thought of the teams below us, like Anaheim, Los Angeles, the Oilers, what are those teams getting Jack Hughes or Kaapo Kakko? It irks me for sure. I mean, you know, LA and Anaheim have done a ton of winning over the past 10, 12 seasons. They got some cups to their name. Obviously, no one wants to see the Oilers get the first overall pick. And what the Canucks really need is another impact winger or a guy like Bowen Byram. I think that would be the best case situation for the Canucks. As great as those other guys are in the top 10, you know, it's really about trying to get one of the top picks for the Canucks. And the draft's in Vancouver. You know, I'll be at that draft. I want to see us draft Jack Hughes or Kaapo Kakko. I mean, that'd be great. So that's what's best for the organization. At the same time, I do think there's something about the team actually putting together some wins in March and pushing for the playoffs. For the past 3 seasons, this team has been absolutely abysmal in March. They had 3 wins in March in 2015-16. They had 4 wins in March in 2016-17. They had 5 wins in March last year. So that's 3 straight seasons where you've just bottomed out in March. And I do think there's something mentally that happens with those players when March turns the corner if they keep losing in March. So I do want to see them make a push here just for the sake of the players. And right now that's happening. I think ideally for the Canucks, you want to see Horvat, Pettersson, and Besser play hockey, put up points, which they're doing. And you want to see them probably lose some games and improve their draft position. But at the same time, man, Elias Pettersson in the playoffs would be pretty awesome. Not going to lie. I might be getting tickets to that, my second playoff game.
It'd be awesome, but
it would be awesome.
I don't know how long it would last, per se.
I agree with you. And I will say, though, and maybe this is just a hunch, I don't have nothing to back this up, I'm not sold on the Flames. I know they're the best team in the West right now. I like the Sharks and I like the Knights better than I like the Flames. Again, the Flames just aren't battle-tested in the playoffs. Until they actually prove it, I'm going to be skeptical. I'm skeptical of their goaltending if they can get it done. I think both Mike Smith and David Rittich, they're both Jekyll and Hyde goaltenders. So I'm just not quite sold on the Flames. I could see someone upsetting the Flames in the first round. Not to say the Canucks will do it, but I do think if the Canucks come in hot, they could steal a couple games from the Flames and make things interesting.
It's interesting you say that for sure. I mean, Mike Smith is, as we all know, and as we colloquially... Can I speak, please? Colloquially, yes? Yes? Did I get that
something
right?
Like that. Something like that.
Third time's a charm? I'm not cutting this out. This is absolutely going to be in the episode.
Fantastic.
Mike Smith is, as we call him, not a good goalie. But David Rittich is better than that. But you are right. So while Rittich is a clear and vast improvement over Mike Smith, the idea that he's going to be the elite starter right now that the Flames need is not as concrete as perhaps the Flames would like it to be. However, they didn't make it this far. They are currently on top of the West they have 9 games left to play, but they have been 5-5 in their last 10. That might just be kind of there could be a lot of reasons behind that. But right now they're kind of in the middle, but they're still tops in the West. So you can't really dive deep into that one, at least for now. If they dive out of the first spot in the West or first spot in the Pacific, because the Sharks are at 94 points, the Flames are at 97, but the Sharks have lost 3 in a row. So they're kind of stuck in a rut here as well. Meanwhile, the Golden Knights, the other team that you mentioned, 9-1 in the last 10 games, 3 in a row win streak. They beat the Sharks in the last game 7-3. I mean, this is a team that was streaky for some parts in the year and wasn't looking good early on in the year at all. They were out of it for, if I remember correctly, a good month or two into the season, and then they turned it around and they got better. And then they got Mark Stone, which turned everything around, and now they're unbeatable almost. And I wasn't sold on the Golden Knights until Benson Vegas came on the show right before the season started and convinced me to believe in the Knights. And I said on the show that I was a firm believer of the Knights, and here they are, 87 points. So I can't say they won't be contenders either, because I said earlier that I would be a firm believer, and here I am still being a firm believer of the Vegas Golden Knights. But I don't even know if Calgary could lose in the first round, because I just feel like whoever they play, right, they'll just outscore them. If whoever they play scores 4 goals, they'll score 5 because of how deep that offense is. And they still have Giordano on the blue line, Noah Hannafin. I mean, they have a lot of talent to go around. And if their goaltender has a bad game, they could easily just outscore the other team and kind of cover that up at least until rounds 2 and beyond.
Yeah, no, that offense is pretty deadly. And, you know, it always haunts Canuck fans to see Matthew Tkachuk lighting it up, because, you know, we got a guy drafted ahead of him who hasn't played an NHL game yet, but that's a topic for another day. The Flames offense is a scary thing to face. They got lots of depth. I think that's one thing that was scarce in the past. Their defense is great, too. I think they have a great blue line with, you know, Giordano, who's my front runner for the Norris. You know, Brody and Hannafin, they're solid defenders, too. For me, it's just the goaltending. The goaltending has to be solid. And I do wonder if the Flames face a team like the Dallas Stars. The Dallas Stars have Ben Bishop and Anton Khudobin. I talked before how Markstrom is top 10 in save percentage since December 1st. Well, Bishop and Khudobin are 1-2 in save percentage. You know, those two guys, they have the ability to shut the net down. And I mean, a team like Dallas, it doesn't score a lot, so that's a problem. But I just wonder how a defensive-minded team will do against the Flames. I think that's the only way the Flames are going to face problems. because you're right. I don't think you're outscoring the Flames. You're going to have to win on defense.
One last question here before I let you go. How does the future of the Canucks look like? What's the prospect situation like? And how deep is the future of the Canucks? Or are they kind of short on future talent? Obviously, they have Pettersson and Besser already up in the NHL. And they have Quinn Hughes as well coming up. I would assume next season is going to be an NHL player. But as of besides those names, how good is the future of this team? And do they really super need an in-close, up-close and personal look at this draft? Or can they potentially trade some of these picks away and get a potential top four defenseman, who they need right now, or another top six forward to complement Besser and Pettersson and Horvat? I mean, what do you think the future of this team looks like?
Well, you know what? The prospect depth in Vancouver, I think everyone was touting how great it was for the last couple of years. But, you know, with Pettersson in the NHL now and Quinn Hughes about to make his debut, he could play before the end of the season if health permits. He's with the team right now. Other than that, it's a little bit scarce right now. And I'm kind of torn because I think the Canucks do need to be aggressive and take advantage of the years where Pettersson and Hughes are making, you know, the league minimum for entry-level contracts, or the league maximum, I should say, on entry-level contracts. But at the same time, I mean, I just don't think Benning can get in the game of dealing away draft picks. I mean, he should have been trading for draft picks. He should have been doing what your Rangers have been doing. Like, man, I look at what the Rangers have done, stockpiling picks over the past couple of years. And, you know, they're set for the future with, you know, a lot of dart throws. The Canucks just don't have that. So I really think they need another impact player. They need really two more impact players. They need one more impact forward, and they need one more impact defenseman. I don't know how you're going to find them other than the draft.
Hey, man, the Canucks have 3 sixth-round picks this year.
Ooh,
so
yeah.
They have that going for them. And they have Anaheim's 7th-round pick next year. They don't have their own, but they do have Anaheim's.
Oh yeah, those 6th-round picks for sure. I mean, 666. It's gonna be a dangerous day at the draft, that's for sure.
Hey man, as long as Aaron Maine's performing there, then I'm all set. As long as they're there performing the song, I will be there.
You'll be dancing. I know you will.
Oh yeah, I saw them twice, and they were incredible both times I saw them. I'm honestly wearing an Iron Maiden shirt right now. One of the shirts that I bought while at the concert, because I mean, I don't know if you could go to a concert and not buy a tour shirt. I mean, I don't know how you could do it. I feel like I don't know. Maybe this is a hot take. Maybe it's a cold take. I have no idea. But I feel like you can't go to a concert and not buy the tour shirt. If you don't buy the tour shirt, then how do people know that you went that you went to the show? No, well, I feel like the most important part about buying the tour shirt is is kind of just memorabilia, right? Like you were there. It's a cool shirt, whatever it is, and it's kind of a symbol that you wear, right? Some memorabilia you hang up on your wall or you put on your desk. This one is something that you wear, right? So I feel like you can't go to a concert and not buy one of the shirts that they have for the tour.
Andrew, I'm picturing at your house just a room full of shirts and Rangers memorabilia. Like, you can't even see the walls. It's just 30 concert shirts. You know, you got a couple of jerseys, a few posters. You got to start putting posters and shirts on the ceiling because you're running out of room. Am I wrong here? Or?
A little bit. I mean, the shirts that I buy for tours and stuff, I wear. I mean, I'm not just going to buy the shirt and then not wear it. But you were sort of right about the posters. I did have a fair share of posters in my college room. I haven't put any of them up in my room since. But I did have my fair share of Rangers posters and music posters. I had my Iron Maiden poster, Megadeth, Slayer. You know, you name it. I had my posters on there. Also a Ghost tapestry. Great band. I feel like people are ragging on them, but Ghost. Ghost opened for Iron Maiden in 2017, I think, when I saw them, and they were fantastic. I mean, I don't know how people are ragging on Ghost, but anyway, music and posters and I guess tapestries aside, Trev, this has been an absolute fantastic conversation. Tell people where they can read your stuff and where they can follow you on social media.
Well, you can follow me at Trev Beggs. That's Beggs for those who want to spell Beggs like the normal way you spell Beggs. This is the Irish way with two G's. And I write for Canucks Misconduct, proud website from SB Nation for the Vancouver Canucks. I also write for the Daily Hive Vancouver, another website that can be found across Canada. And then you can hear me giving some hot takes, some funny takes on Silky and Filthy, my hockey podcast with my buddy Kyle Bowen.
Awesome, Trev. Really appreciate you coming on. I messaged you on a little bit of a short notice here, and I appreciate you you turning around and getting back to me and also hopping on board the show this week. Really appreciate it. And this has been awesome, and I'll talk to you real soon.
Yeah, we'll see you again soon, Andrew. Happy to come on.
Absolutely. And this has been episode number 40 of Cho Squared. Again, round numbers. Who does not love a great round number? Episode 41 next week. I'll talk to you then.